This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, if you live in those couple of dozen states where voting has already begun, then you have already might maybe cast your vote in this election year. And this year, it's already shaping up to be deja vu all over again, as reports of problems with electronic voting machines in Florida and voter registration problems in other states trickle in. Now, about a third of the country's voters will be using electronic voting machines. Now, these machines are user-friendly. They can be programmed in multiple languages, but they may or may not leave a paper trail should a recount be called for. In the primaries earlier this year, some machines failed to boot up, others couldn't read data cards, and dead batteries in some computers sent voters home without counting their votes. In some instances, major security flaws were uncovered. Voters in some parts of Missouri and Ohio are sticking with the simple paper punch card ballot, the same type that brought the hanging chad into our vocabulary. In Pennsylvania, a flood of newly registered voters is worrying election officials that these registrations may not be processed in time for Election Day, 11 days away and counting. So up first this hour, we'll be talking about some new, some of the old voting technologies that voters can be expected to see in this election. Also, seven ways to make sure that your vote is counted. You've cast your ballot. How do you know that it's actually going to be counted? We'll talk about ways you can know that it will be counted or try to ensure that it is. And if you'd like to get into our conversation, you're welcome as always. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, and surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for other resources. Let me introduce my first guests. Michael Alvarez is a professor of political science at Caltech and co-director of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. He joins us by phone from his office at Caltech in Pasadena. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Alvarez.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Annalee Newitz is the author of Sorry, Your Vote Has Been Lost, Hacked, Miscast, Recorded Twice, an article coming out in the November issue of Popular Science. She also writes the syndicated column Texploitation, and she is a media coordinator and policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She joins us from her office in San Francisco. Thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Newitz.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Michael Alvarez, in 2002, following the fiasco in Florida, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act. Now, is the goal of that to lose fewer votes or to get more people to vote?
I think it had a combination of goals. I think both those were important things that the Help America Vote Act sought to do. It really, you know, I think represented an infusion of money into states to purchase new voting systems. It really is requiring states to hopefully fix up in positive ways the ways in which they register voters. It requires roughly half the states that did not have provisional or fail-safe balloting in the 2000 election to have that in place for this election. And it has, you know, a wide variety of other requirements and regulations in it that, you know, hopefully will lead to a better process this fall.
Do you think we're going to be improved this next couple of weeks?
Well, I'm taking a deep breath. I sure hope so. You know, I'd love to wake up on November 3rd and find out that there weren't any snafus. But, you know, I think seriously what we're going to find is that there are a lot of new people going out to vote. There's a lot of changes that have taken place throughout the country. Polling place workers will be grappling with a lot of new voters and, again, a lot of new technologies and a lot of new ways of doing business. Those are going to lead to problems. And there's, you know, different places in the country, which I think you highlighted already, where some things are going to be particularly problematic. For example, Ohio, where 70% of voters are going to be using punch cards. Florida, electronic voting machines. Pennsylvania is going to be using a new statewide voter registration database for the first time, which there have been some small reports of some, you know, minor problems associated with that as they've gone into Election Day. So, you know, we're watching things throughout the country, and, yeah, I would expect to see problems.
Let me ask both of you, you know, and whenever you have a new technology, whether it's voting or trying to put a man on the moon, whenever you have a lot of new technology, you have to allow time to shake out. Annalee, do you think we haven't given electronic voting enough time to shake the cobwebs out before we put it into practice?
I mean, I think that's the main problem that we're encountering here. I mean, one of the pitfalls of the Help America Vote Act, as great as it was that a lot of the money that it allocated for upgrading the voting infrastructure had to be spent right away. And in most cases, that meant being spent by this election. And so a lot of county officials and state officials were having to just rush headlong into a huge upgrade and a huge transformation in their voting infrastructure, and they simply didn't know enough about the technology in some cases to make informed decisions, and they didn't consult with computer scientists and security experts. And in some states, like Texas, for example, they didn't even hold open meetings for the public to come in and look at the machines before they were chosen. And so I think you just saw a lot of very fast decisions that, in retrospect, may not have been the best ones.
What do you see as the biggest problem with the electronic voting system?
I think that the main problem that we're going to see is probably going to come from the fact that a lot of poll workers and a lot of voters simply aren't used to the technology. There are, of course, very grave concerns about the security of the machines, but I think we're going to see a lot more just mundane problems, like problems with booting up, problems with having the right ballot on the right machine. A lot of people who've been doing early voting have reported that they've had trouble with the touch screens where they've voted for the wrong candidate because they've pushed the screen in the wrong way, and it's taken, you know, half an hour for the poll workers to figure out how to take back that vote and make the correct vote. So that's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, you have to call up the person, the techie guy or lady who knows how to fix these things.
Yeah, in a lot of cases that is true.
Yeah. Do you see that too, Michael?
Oh, yeah. I think that with these new voting systems, there are a lot of usability issues that range from, you know, exceptionally mundane things like you were just discussing to, you know, questions about the fonts and how readable they are for people who may be colorblind and lots of those kinds of issues. I think the way to view this, though, is to consider, well, relative to what? You know, are we going to be in a better situation with these new technologies relative to what we saw in 2000? And I think in some places the answer may be yes. In other places, the answer may be no or may be unknown until after the election.
I think one of the issues, and I guess at the bottom of the issue, is do you trust the results with these machines more than you would trust them with the old system?
Well, I've voted on them, so I'd rather vote on the touchscreens myself than punch cards.
Yeah, the big issue, of course, I mean, there's a huge voter trust issue, and I think this is going to come out more after the election, where if, you know, counties or states that have touchscreen machines need to do a recount and they don't have a paper audit trail, we're going to run into problems with, well, what exactly is a recount? Is it just a reprint of the first, you know, vote? You just, oh, print it out again? And certainly in California, we've actually seen cases where a county has been asked to do a recount, and they've said, sure, we'll give you a reprint of the ballots as you first saw them. And so that's not really a recount. That's just printing it out again. Mm-hmm. So how do we define recount in a situation where what we may have is simply, you know, a copy of the memory in the machine, and that copy may have the same errors as the original vote did?
Right. You don't see how it was tallied in the machine.
Yeah. And because there's no paper trail, it's difficult for voters to be confident that the vote that they saw go into the machine is the vote that wound up in there.
Do any of the new voting systems allow you to choose, you know, between paper and plastic, so to speak, between an electronic voting and a paper ballot?
They do. In California, the Secretary of State has actually issued a mandate that says voters who request paper at the polls may vote on paper. So even if you go to a polling place and it's all touchscreen machines, you have that option. And one of the scandals that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been working on actually is that a lot of poll workers have been told not to tell voters that they have this option. Mm-hmm. They certainly will provide them with paper if they're asked, but they're not told to tell voters, hey, you have this option to vote on paper.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to James in Miami. Hi, James. Have you voted yet?
No, not yet, because I'm just worried about if I go ahead and vote early, what going to guarantee me that vote won't be changed anytime between now and November?
Oh, good question.
And second thing that I'm worried about is in the state of Florida, you have that if the percent is going towards one candidate, that's when they have a recount. But what about if they modify the programs where the program says, okay, we'll give this candidate more, then they don't have to have a recount.
Michael Alvarez? Legitimate concerns?
On the latter, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but on the former, you know, what happens with early votes or absentee votes of any sort, be they paper or electronic, you know, there are procedures and protocols in place that election officials follow to store those ballots in secure ways, and then they bring them out after close of elections on election day and tabulate them. So, you know, barring you know, very elaborate efforts by someone to break through those procedures and protocols and security, I would anticipate that there shouldn't be those sorts of problems.
And James, is your second point, you think that the software in the election machine may be programmed, if it sees the vote going in one way, to go the other way? Is that what you're saying?
I'm in computers, okay, and I know that you could do many things. You can have a bug that turns on the day of the election. You could do whatever you want to with software. Okay, the only thing I'm worried about is the elections. The recount only happens if the percent is so close between the two candidates. Yes or no?
That's a good question. At what point do we decide that we're going to recount here?
Exactly, because if the percent goes higher towards one candidate than the other, then they can say, well, we don't need to recount.
Right.
So whatever the program has done it.
Michael Alvarez, any trusting the software?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, we're at a point now where, you know, these systems have been tested and certified both at the federal and state level. And, you know, they do go through a pretty thorough regimen of testing. And one would hope that before they would be rolled out to voters, that those sorts of bugs or deliberate malicious code would have been spotted. I think that what would happen in a situation like that is that it would be difficult to you know, ascertain before the election, but what will happen after the election is that there's going to be a very thorough, what I would call, forensic analysis done in particularly close races throughout the country. And again, I think when you would see those sorts of anomalies, there will be, I think, very careful examination after the fact, and then you'll get into a situation where the courts will have to decide what to do.
All right, Jane. Thanks for calling. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that I think that a hacking of the election is far less likely than simply that machines will crash and people will be turned away from the polls. I mean, I think that's what people need to be worried about more than a kind of nefarious conspiracy.
Yeah, it's easier to turn people away than to hack the machines. That's what your point is.
Yeah.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about voting coming up. People have started voting. Let me see if I can get a quick call in before we have to take the break. Liz, quickly, from Palm Beach, Florida.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, hi. The reason I'm calling is...
Turn your radio down.
Sure, there it goes. You know, in the first election, nobody wanted to talk about the fact that the margin of error of the voting equipment itself in Florida was far in excess of what either candidate could claim as per victory, and that really the only way we were going to determine who won Florida was to have a revote of the state. If that occurs again, are we going to run into that same difficulty where if we have voting equipment that's got margin of error in the thousands of votes, and the election is being decided by a few hundred, what is the point of a recount in that case?
Dr. Alvarez?
Well, it's a very good question, because, you know, you could hold the vote again using the same voting systems, and I don't think that's going to resolve the issue unless we did something like, you know, hold the vote 100 or 1,000 times so we could really get a grip on what the confidence interval looks like.
All right. Let me go to a break. On the other side of the break, we'll continue the answer so I can give you time to do a full answer. We do have to take a break. We'll be right back talking lots more about the vote to Michael Alvarez and Annalee Newitz. Stay with us. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about voting technology, how it might influence this year's election, with my guest, Michael Alvarez, professor of political science at Caltech and co-director of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. Annalee Newitz, the author of Sorry, Your Vote Has Been Lost, Hacked, Miscast, Recorded Twice, coming out in the November issue of Popular Science. When I really interrupted Dr. Alvarez, he was telling us about what happens when you have a really close election. Will a revote do anything?
It's hard to really think that a revote would do anything other than, you know, generate another vote with some sort of uncertainty associated with it. So, You know, what I do think we have to do is, if it's very close, like it's going to be in Florida and some of these other states where we know there is a margin of error, we're just going to have to let the process work its way out. They'll have recounts, there'll be litigation, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah. Let's talk, Annalee, about there's a little article, a sidebar that you have in your article in the Popular Science about a system by David Chaum for suggesting that cryptography could solve the e-voting security woes. Could you explain that?
Sure. Well, he's basically created a system that allows you to not only have an auditable election, which is to say an election with a paper trail, but he's also set it up so that all of your votes, you know, through using cryptography, are completely anonymized when they go into the computer. And so the beauty part is that when you take home your encrypted voting receipt, it'll have a little number on it so that you can go online and you can check to see that that number, you know, has that number of the ballot is on there and has been counted. But you can also, through decrypting some of these anonymized votes, actually audit the entire election yourself, which is an incredibly, you know, great idea, and I think is, you know, exactly what sort of technologically enhanced democracy is all about. You know, I don't think this is something we're going to see, you know, in the next election, but say 10 years out, I think
right.
It would be great.
So you could watch the polls change as they come in?
Absolutely. And because his system really does anonymize the votes, you can basically look at all the ballots and make sure that they've all been counted and make sure that the results as reported are the results as you see them coming in online.
Michael Alvarez, you have seven steps to make sure that your vote is counted. Let's go through those steps.
Okay, well, these are actually really kind of commonsensical things that we've recommended that people can do at this point in time. You know, one is, in particular, if you're a newly registered voter, call ahead and make sure that you are on the right list of voters and you know where your precinct is. The second is, if you're in a jurisdiction where you get a sample ballot, read it, and read it carefully, in particular, if you're a first-time voter and you're using a new voting system.
If you're doing electronic voting, will they send you something, how to push the buttons or the screen?
Well, if you look in your sample ballot or you call your local county election or state election official, they a lot of times will have material on their website, which will walk you through that. Or in many places, they will actually have demonstration models where you can actually go and play with the new technology to get used to it before you vote.
All right, number three.
Bring your sample ballot. If you have one, bring it. Like out here in California where we have incredibly complicated ballots, if you mark your sample ballot beforehand, you can bring it in the polling place with you, and that can help speed the process up for you, as well as give you a really simple way to check to make sure that you're voting for what you think you should be voting for.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth thing is, if you're going to vote on Election Day, try to avoid the early morning hours and the evening hours. Try to vote sometime, say, between 10 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. Those are going to be the places, especially in the battleground states, where the line should be the shortest on Election Day. Next, one of the big changes with HAVA is every state's required to provide voters in precincts or in their sample ballots with a list of their voting rights. And voters should take a look at those, either in their ballots or their precincts, know what they are, and always, if you need help in a precinct, ask for it. Polling place workers are there to help. Next is provisional balloting. Every voter has a right now, if you're registered in your precinct and your name doesn't appear on the list of registered voters in the precinct, to cast a provisional ballot. So you have that right, and you need to make sure that the polling place workers give you that provisional ballot if you're registered to vote in that precinct.
If they're not informed, they may deny you the ballot?
They may not, you know, as I think we were talking about earlier, in some cases, be very proactive about offering it.
I see.
So make sure you know you're right and make sure that you ask for that provisional ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And the last, I think, is the simplest, but I think may actually mitigate many problems with uncounted ballots, and that's just stop and check. Stop and check that ballot has reflected your intentions, either paper or electronic. You know, before you get to a point where you hit the red button or you stick it in the box, just take the time to check it. And if there's anything wrong, stop and ask for a new ballot. They'll give you one.
Mm-hmm. One last question, Annalee. Should there be a uniform? You know, why not have everybody vote the same way? Have one uniform kind of voting machine?
Well, I think that it's simply impossible to have something like that, because if you want to have a competitive market for the best voting machines, you know, you're always going to have a number of different vendors offering different kinds of things. But what I think we can do, and I think we should do, is have, you know, mandates that define, you know, what each machine needs to have in order to make it secure, in order to make it have an auditable capacity, whether that's a paper trail or in the future some other kind of audit capacity, and that they be incredibly user-friendly so that, you know, you're not going to see the problems with people pushing the wrong button or having trouble dealing with the interface. And I just wanted to add that if people are having trouble on election day, the National Election Protection Coalition has thousands of legal and technical experts who are going to be waiting by the phones at 1-866-OUR-VOTE to answer technical questions or any legal questions you have about troubles that you have at the polls.
I understand that there are even some people stationed at the polls if you walk out and you feel you haven't voted right.
There will be. There'll be legal experts doing that. And also, if you call that number and you're having a technical problem, it's very likely that a technical team can actually come out. A third-party team, not somebody necessarily from the vendor, who can look at the machines and troubleshoot.
Well, then one last question for both of you. Will there be any early signs of problems in the system?
I think we're already seeing early signs of problems, unfortunately. Early voting in Florida, people were turned away from the polls for hours because they couldn't, you know, get the machines booted up right, and they couldn't load the ballots. And so I think, you know, let's hope that there's not any problems, and definitely people should go out to vote, but it looks like there may be some glitches.
Michael Alvarez?
Oh, yeah, I think we've already seen the tip of the iceberg, and we will see problems in many states. But again, you know, there are voters who can do a lot of simple things to try and alleviate those problems by just following some, you know, commonsensical rules.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you both for taking time to talk with us this hour. Michael Alvarez is professor of political science at Caltech and co-director of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. And Emily Newitz is author of Sorry Your Vote Has Been Lost, Hacked, Miscast, Recorded Twice, coming out in the November issue of Popular Science. She also writes a syndicated column, Texploitation, and she is a media coordinator and policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks.
Next up this hour, election science, polling. The presidential election, as we say, is, about 11 days away, and according to the latest poll, your candidate has already lost. Wait a minute. They changed that channel, and a new poll puts him in second place, and pick up a newspaper, suddenly the race is a dead heat. How can the polls be so different? There are no shortages of polls in this year's presidential election, no shortage of results. And now come charges of biased polling. This week, the group MoveOn.org took out a full-page ad in the New York Times charging that the Gallup polls are manipulated to favor President Bush. Is this just a case of shooting the messenger, or are the partisans generally worried that a poll result can influence the election outcome? So for the rest of this hour, we're going to take a look at how polls are designed, what they can and can't tell us about election results. Can they really predict anything? And how does the way the questions are phrased, does that affect the outcome of a poll and maybe the order of the questions? What about the upsurge in voter registration? How might that affect the polls? Are these registered, you know, these new voters, people who haven't voted before, are we missing them in the polling? You know, we talk about those people likely to vote. Are they not being included in those polls? And who are these all-important, make sure you reach them, how can they not have made up their minds by now, undecided voters? How do we reach them? How do we know who they are and how many there are? And if you'd like to join our discussion, our number 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guests. Cliff Zukin is vice president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. He's also a professor of public policy at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He joins us today by phone. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
You're welcome. Scott Keeter is the director of survey research at the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, and he joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about how polling is done. Can you give us an idea how do you put a poll together? Do you take an old poll and rework it, or do you start out from scratch?
Well, it really depends on what your objectives are.
Mm-hmm.
I think any good project starts with a state of objectives, and then what you're trying to do with a poll is to achieve certain goals. Mm-hmm. And you would make different decisions if you were looking for voters in an election than if you were trying to evaluate a program or if you were trying to take a sample of the citizenry as a whole.
Let's talk about this election. Let me ask both of you, why do we see so many different, you know, so many different polls, so many different results? Scott?
Well, I looked at, over the past 5 days, eight major national polls, and I looked at not just at the margin between the two candidates, but at the number estimated support for each of the candidates. And what I saw is not a tremendous amount of variation. In fact, the amount of variation that you see is not much greater than you might expect by chance. And so let me just read off the numbers here. President Bush is getting between 46% and 51% in these eight polls. That's a difference of 5 points in absolute terms, but if you knocked off the top and the bottom one, you'd actually only have a 2-point variation. Kerry is subject to a little more variation, but that would be expected because he's the person that's less known. So really there are two reasons why I think we're seeing the variability we do. One of them is the variation we always see, which is sampling error. And the other is the fact that the organizations that I'm talking about here have different methods for determining who is going to vote, the so-called likely voter scales. And differences in how they treat the likelihood of voting are going to make a difference in what the margin is.
Cliff?
Well, I think Scott's right. He's essentially arguing that if you were to just look at the estimates of registered voters, there'd be a lot of similarity. So the science of it is very much the same, but then when different polling organizations do the artwork of it, trying to separate wheat from chaff and trying to figure out of all those people who tell you they're going to vote how many really are, they have different methods and they produce different results. But I think since we're on a science show, it's very important to realize, Ira, that we're making estimates. Polls are estimates where we take samples to infer what's going on in the population. And since it's based on probability theory, there's going to be some variation in estimates, the same way that if you flipped a coin 10 times, you probably wouldn't always expect it to turn up five heads and five tails. Sometimes it'd be 6 of 1, sometimes 4 of 1. So the estimates will probably cluster around whatever the real population value is, but there's always going to be estimation and variance. And one of the things that I think is sort of, the more we do this, the more problems we cause ourselves. I counted 16 national polls out. So as Scott said, he looked in the last 5 days and found, what, 8 of them?
Yeah, right.
You know, so there's almost got to be some variation just because of the basic science of probability theory and mathematics that underlies polling.
We're talking about polling this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Sometimes you get the impression that people are just making polls for the publicity of the poll. They don't care what the results are. They want to get their names. The pollsters want to get their names in the newspapers.
Well, I certainly think there's some credence to that. The new polls that have come out this year are trying to get names for themselves. And, of course, in this country right now, we've come into a situation where the media industry really owns the polling industry. So the prominent pollsters now are ABC, Washington Post, CBS, New York Times, NBC, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Gallup, USA Today, Time, Newsweek, AP. There are very few independents out there like the old Gallup and Harris. The Pew Center that Scott is with is one of them. But that's one of the reasons I think we're seeing so many polls, and also some very bad polling, such as one-day polls done after debates.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott, let's talk a bit about who is sort of left out in the polling. You know, we hear the people who are likely to vote, and we've also seen that there are tremendous increases in registered voters and young people who are voting. Aren't these the people that normally are left out of the polling situation as being unlikely to vote because they don't fit that demographic?
Well, the method that we use, which is called random digit dialing, gives every residential household in the country an equal chance of being included. But there's some limitations there. Obviously, people who don't have telephones at all cannot be reached by the polls. And that has historically not created much of a bias in election polls because people without telephones at all tend to be less interested and less engaged in politics. We have a growing group of people, however, who do have telephones, but they're not telephones that we can reach with our samples, and those are the cell phone users. Approximately 6% of households in the United States, according to the Census Bureau, fall into that category, and that's a demographic that actually tilts pretty young. And so there is a potential concern, though, I think we can speak to that as well. And then finally, even though we give every household the same chance of getting in, we don't end up giving every person the same chance, in part because people vary in how willing they are to do surveys and how accessible they are to us. Young people, again, tend to be out more often. And as a result of that, if we don't design the survey in such a way to make multiple calls to households, we may underrepresent them. Now, in all those cases, I think we've got some good fixes for it, but that's what the nature of the problem could be.
Do you aim for a certain person in the house when you call it?
Our method for selecting a person in the household is to ask first for the youngest male who is currently at home, and if there is no male at home, we ask for the oldest female. This method has been shown over time to give a very good distribution in terms of gender and age. Other polling organizations use random selection within the household, and depending on how that's done, it can create problems because it may take some time on the phone at the beginning before you've established rapport with the respondents. But no reputable poll just takes whoever answers the phone. If you do that, you'll end up with a very skewed sample of people who are often home, and you'll end up with a lot more women than men.
Mm-hmm. So there's some artwork here. It's not just the science, it's a little bit of calling the shots.
You have to make decisions on how you select a household, how you select a respondent, your question wording, your question ordering, and also who you determine to be likely voters. And in that sense, there are a number of different decisions that go into any election pollster's set, and each set's going to look a little different.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, and take your questions and get into the details of how these polls are done a little bit more if you're interested in that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science of polling with my guest, Scott Keeter, Director of Survey Research at the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, Cliff Zukin, Vice President of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, if you'd like to contribute. Let's go to Aaron in Waterford, Connecticut. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, here's the issue. I think it's really ironic, I think, that this is on Science Friday, given that I really think this is an unscientific area. I feel like it's impossible to quantify or qualify someone's emotions that go into why you do or do not vote and who you vote for. For instance, I'm one of those undecided voters, and it has nothing to do with the fact that I haven't made up my mind. I've simply made up my mind that neither candidate appeals to me anymore.
So you're not undecided. You've decided not to vote.
Well, yes, and I feel like, you know, it's one of those things that I don't think is accounted for in the polling system or in this polling of people and how they vote. You know, no one asks, well, you know, are you going to vote? And then why aren't you going to vote? It's the fact that neither candidate is really, either candidate at this point is sort of towing the far end of either line. And I think a lot of people out there feel that way, and they're, you know, quite frankly fed up with the fact that we don't have choices.
Well, what about Nader?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, okay. I'll go there. Let me ask Scott Keeter for Scott. She's undecided, and she's not going to vote. And do you have a way of finding that out in your poll?
Well, yes. The polls that we conduct are with a random sample of everybody, and assuming that we can conduct an interview with her, we would find out that that she's not going to vote. Now, at this point in the campaign, our polling is really focused on voters, and we're interested in trying to make the best prediction, ultimately, of how the election is going to turn out and to explain why people are doing what they're doing. But we are also very interested in voters or non-voters like her. And, in fact, both Cliff and I have been engaged in a lot of research over the years about just this topic, about disengagement from politics.
Mm-hmm. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, I guess we lost him. We lost the line or something to Scott. Scott, are you there? Cliff, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Maybe you can pick up his thought. Is there? How come I don't hear a category of Aarons that says undecided and doesn't want to vote?
Well, we're actually going to record Aaron. When we report it, though, we will probably leave her out of the statistic because we'll report the distribution of voters. In the Pew Research Center, if Scott was going to be able to answer this
question, we'll get him back.
He would tell you that when they read the question, that if someone says, I'm not going to vote for president, they would record that answer.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we're trying to get a representative sampling of everyone, and certainly one of the stories of the election is the number of citizens who don't participate.
Well, because when we hear the statistics, there's a 7% whatever it is, I'll make up the number of undecided voters. If you're like Aaron, right, you're decided. She's not undecided. She has decided. She's just not going to vote.
Right.
So it's like misleading to keep hearing those statistics over again.
Well, we wouldn't call her an undecided voter.
I see.
We would say that she is someone who has decided not to vote. The undecided voters we're talking to are people we still think are likely to vote, and I can tell you how we go through that, and have not simply made a choice between Kerry and Bush.
Scott, well, you're back, I understand.
I'm back.
I don't know if you could hear what Cliff was saying.
I didn't hear anything.
He said that voters like Aaron would be recorded, as you know, they would not put her in the undecided category. You too?
Well, if she told us she wasn't going to vote, then she would be accounted as a non-likely voter and wouldn't be analyzed. If she was undecided and thought and said that she would vote, then she would be included and she would be in our percentages. And in fact, we'll pay a lot of attention to undecided voters who tell us that they do intend to turn out. We'll try to figure out what they're going to do.
Ira, one of the hardest things that we have to do is to find out who likely voters really are, in that people over-report their vote intentions to us. If we simply asked all registered voters if they plan to vote in the election, we might get 90% or in the high 80% who said yes, they are.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that's too high. What each pollster has to do is to try and separate out who's really likely to vote from everybody who says they are. And most pollsters will use a combination of three different types of measures. One is they'll look at how engaged people are. Those who are very interested or following the campaign closely or care about who wins. Second, they'll ask about past voting behavior on the basis that most people who do vote tend to be regular. And then they'll look at the reported intentions. And if I recall right, Dr. Keeter, the Pew Research Center uses some 7 questions to do that.
That's right. Very similar to what Gallup does.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Aaron, for calling. And if you change your mind, call us back.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask both of you. There are so many polls, and now, with the internet and with the cable news 24 hours, we're hearing instant polling. Are there polls we should stay away from paying attention to?
Absolutely.
Tell us about those.
Any poll where respondents select themselves has no basis in scientific fact. And in fact, we do what are called probability samples, where we go out and select respondents. So I would say any poll that invites people to opt in has no scientific basis.
Give me an example.
A call-in poll.
On a TV show or something.
On a TV show. Mm-hmm. An internet survey where people are not selected by the researcher, but in fact get there through some gate that says we want to express our opinion.
Right.
Those are not representative.
In the aftermath of after the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke with Bill Clinton, AOL put an instant poll on their site and had, I think, a couple of million people vote on whether they thought President Clinton should be removed from office, and a big majority said that he should be. Every scientific poll that was taken at the same time found big majorities saying that he should not be.
Mm-hmm. The MoveOn.org organization has been accusing the Gallup people of biasing their vote. Do you have any response to that?
Yeah, I've been a practicing pollster for about 25 years, and the one thing that matters most to you if you're doing polling is getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
I do know the people at Gallup, and I know people at every polling organization. I've never seen a case where these published polls try to influence results because their reputation, and more to the point, their business over the next 4 years, rises and falls with their perceived accuracy. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that most of these people are professionals who take their job quite seriously. They don't want to be the story themselves.
1-800-999-8255. In doing research on, you know, you try to look for scientific research on polling. It's not easy to find. I did find an interesting study that was put out in 2000 that talked about how you ask the vote. And this study said, if you ask the question, who will you vote for, you know, today? Who, you know, if you're going to vote for it today, who would you vote for? You get a different response than who will you vote for on election day? And are you familiar with that difference? I mean, it just I think the difference showed up in how many undecided voters that they came up with.
Right, right. I mean, clearly, if you ask people to project what they're going to do in the future, they're going to have more uncertainty about what they're going to do, and you're probably not going to get as good a reading of what they're thinking at the moment. And so we ask, and I think most organizations ask, if the election were held today. But then we try to be careful not to say that the poll we release now, for example, the poll that we put out this week, we try not to say that that is a prediction of what's going to happen, that that is a reading of what the campaign, where the campaign stands right now. On election weekend, we will put out a prediction poll, but we try not to say that the things that we do in the pre-election period are predictions.
They in this survey found that if you asked who you're going to vote for on election day, the undecided rate was much lower than if you asked who you're going to vote today for today. I think it was 23% versus 8%, and when they actually did ballot those people who voted. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we got time before the break. Yeah, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Bruce in Boulder. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you, Neil?
Hi there.
I really enjoy your show. I had a question. The gentleman who said when they were calling for polls, what happens to people who are on no-call list, or what about people who are not listed or have unlisted phone numbers? How do they contact them, or are they even contacted?
Let me just quickly remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Those are terrific questions. Polling, because it is research, is not affected by the Do Not Call list. So we're not really governed by that. Professor Keeter before spoke of random digit dial samplings, and that means that if we wanted to reach Bruce in Boulder, and we would know the area code and the exchange for Boulder, but we would make up at random the last four digits, something like that, that would ensure us the ability to pick up people with unlisted numbers and who had recently moved.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. 1-800-989-8255. We all know that polling is just a snapshot of the public opinion at this point. And I think you mentioned, Scott, that is it going to be your last poll will be next weekend?
That's right.
How in retrospect, how accurate is that poll to what actually happens on Election Day?
Well, our record has been very good, and I think collectively, if you look at the National Council of Public Polls, ncpp.org, you can find all of the records of the national polls compared with the outcome, and it's really a very impressive record. It's one of the things that gives us the belief that despite the difficulties that we face in polling, rising refusal rates and the like, that we're still accurately measuring what people think.
Did 4 years ago, did they predict that President Bush would be elected?
Well, 4 years ago, most organizations said that it was too close to call, which I think was an accurate prediction of what happened.
But it's also true that we're talking about national polls, which are the equivalent of the popular vote. And, of course, President Bush was elected on the strength of the electoral vote. Gore actually won the popular vote. It was that close.
Mm-hmm. And the exit polls, should we believe them election night?
Well, the answer is yes. The exit polls also have a very good record over the years. I mean, there have been a couple of very visible exceptions in which the exit polls were wrong.
It was a bad call last time.
Yeah, and that, of course, was a sort of perfect storm because it was not only an exit poll problem but also a vote counting problem. Mm-hmm. But by and large, the exit polls have been very accurate.
It's much easier to estimate accurately when you do it at the time rather than beforehand.
Can you pick up a trend now, you know, a week and a half away? Is there any discernible trend, Scott?
I'm not seeing anything that you could call a trend. The variation in the polls is such that I think right now the average of all the polls gives Bush about a 3-point lead. That might be a little smaller than it was a couple of days ago, but I don't think there's anything that's detectable right now.
I thought the Pew poll yesterday thought there was a little bit of a trend.
Well, I'm doing the average of all of them. We do show it closer than it was, but our last poll before this one was 2 weeks ago, and that's kind of an eternity in politics.
You're illustrating exactly where we started this program.
Yeah.
So you'd rather go with the national whole average instead of your own poll?
Well, I like our poll, and I think it's very good. But if I step back as an educated poll consumer, I think that one way to do it is to not be too confused by the variability of the polls, is to look at all of them and to take the average.
And the last question, do people pay attention to the polls and influence how they vote?
I don't think there's any evidence that there's any sort of a bandwagon effect based on who's ahead. In fact, if you look across the elections in the last 40 or 50 years, the candidate who's been behind in the polls has actually more often come either close or even won the election. So I don't think there's really a sign that the polls are determining what people are doing.
Last word, Cliff?
I think the biggest problem is really that polls are so focused on the horse race rather than on other questions where I think we could have a more positive contribution in the electoral process.
All right. Let me thank both my guests, Cliff Zukin, Vice President of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, also Professor of Public Policy at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, Scott Keeter, Director of Survey Research at the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer and our director. Our interns are Corey Binns and Abby Leonard. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have Science Friday's Kids Connection there, free curricula. Go to the left side of the page, it says for teachers, click on that, and you can download a whole bunch of good stuff for teaching the material we talk on Science Friday. Also, you can download and listen to on Real Audio, back editions of Science Friday, take them with you on your iPod and your Audible player, and also other great links that Charles has put together for our topics. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.